Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran has not been subservient to the U.S. and has not become a vassal state. This explains why Iran's leader has hailed the Islamic Republic as the most promising force in the face of plots pursued by colonial powers, stating that most of their outrageous demands have been resisted and rejected due to Iran's resistance. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what kinds of demands the leader was talking about and why those demands and pressures have failed. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joins us from Marseille in France. Also joining us, journalist and political commentator Sim Mohsen Abbas, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome. Sim Mohsen Abbas, first to you. One of the things that Iran's leader has said, Shia Muslims take great pride in standing up against arrogant powers which interfere in the affairs of other countries, governments, and nations in a cruel and tyrannical manner. Can you expand that for us, please?
Well, lying at the heart of Iran, Islamic Republic of Iran, is an ideology, and this is what quite often both Western analysts, as well, those Western analysts who are antagonistic towards Iran, and Western politicians and Western media very conveniently forget that the Islamic Revolution was based on not only bringing down the arrogant powers as manifested by the Shah of Iran, but it's also based on some fundamental values, the values of justice, the values of courage, and the values of fairness. These are just some of the values which, of course, Islam, which is at the heart of the Islamic Revolution's ideological stand, insists upon. And the leadership of Imam Khomeini, followed by the guidance of Rehbere Mukawama, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has kind of consolidated around these fundamental values. And when Ayatollah Khamenei, therefore, talks about the enmity of the arrogant powers, what he's talking about is a fundamental flaw in the system that lies certainly in the West, and that flaw is based on the lack of virtues, and the key one he picks out there is arrogance, and it is this arrogance which leads the West to try and subjugate Iran, which is its primary objective, by any means necessary. So subjugating Iran, of course, means economically, politically, ideologically. And they go about doing it through, and they have done it, through military means, through economic sanctions, and they've tried it through psychological operations, cultural wars. All of it has been rolled out, and we can go into more of the details of how that's being done.
Sure.
I think this is what Ayatollah Khamenei is talking about, that Iran's defense against that constant attack from all different forms has been a very successful one.
Okay. When we take a look at the way that Iran is actually viewed, Elijah Magnier, by the West, and in particular the U.S., obviously the U.S. has problems with Iran and what it stands for. Taking a close look, however, at what Iran stands for, is not something that is out of the ordinary or is something outrageous. We're looking at, again, some of the statements made today, another which is about standing up to bullying, where Iran's leader described Iran's encouragement of other nations to stand up against bullying as the main reason behind what he said was arrogant powers' wrath and enmity towards the Islamic Republic. What types of things do you think Iran's leader is talking about when he says standing up to bullying?
Well, actually, the Americans really don't care about the religion in Iran or in any other country, and they really are careless about the Sunni or the Shia or any other religion. They are mainly concerned about the country that is submitted to the U.S. hegemony or not submitted to the U.S. hegemony. And Iran, since 1979, showed that it is rejecting the U.S. or any other hegemony, even the Russian or any other country that is trying to impose its will on the Iranian population. So from that on, from that period onward, for America, Iran become an enemy state or a state to be broke, you have to be breaked and bring to submission, and Iran should kneel to the American hegemony of the world. Particularly after the fall of the Soviet Union, Iran remained with a very few countries like Cuba, and after that, many years later, Venezuela, who are rejecting the U.S. hegemony. So from that on, the Americans constructed 35 military bases around Iran in different countries in the Gulf. They even pushed Saddam Hussein to attack Kuwait through the U.S. ambassador in Baghdad. And they attack Iraq to cripple Iraq, but at the end of the day, to be on the border with Iran, because the aim was to submit Iran after Syria and Lebanon. So this is how the Americans understand how countries should function. And countries should function according to the U.S. policy and putting the U.S. Priority above any other priorities, including the national security of any country. We've seen this today happening in Europe. So it is not surprising that the Americans consider Iran as an enemy. The only thing that the Americans want from Iran is just to accept its hegemony, and then Iran can be the leader of all the nations in the Middle East. And that would be extremely happy for the Americans to do, as long as Iran submit to the Americans. And we've seen today with the nuclear deal, Iran is showing that its national interests come first and not the U.S. hegemony.
So following that train of thought, Saymohsen Abbas, we're looking at the fact that the U.S. Throughout the decades since the Islamic Revolution has not been able to obviously make Iran subservient to its foreign policy objectives, particularly in this region. It has subscribed to something that has really reared an ugly head way back, and it showed itself back in 2003 particularly, and that's the whole issue of sectarianism when the U.S. waged a war against Iraq. Tell us the way that the U.S. used that card, and how what kind of function did Iran have in that to basically defeat the consequences that arose out of that U.S. push?
Well, this notion of a Shia crescent popped up quite early on in this century, perhaps even slightly before. And initially, it was the Jordanians and the Arabs who were allied to the Americans who started pushing this idea of a Shia crescent. And that was the first time one heard of this kind of new narrative that was being pushed out ultimately by American intelligence agencies and all those that were allied to them. And it was really designed to create a fear, first of all, amongst Sunnis. So there was this sectarian effort to divide the Middle East along Shia and Sunni lines, and they went for it, and they still continue to go for it. It's, of course, it's kind of most vicious and venomous manifestations, of course, are Daesh and ISIS, who are well known across the world now to have been a kind of head-cutting, very ruthless, very nasty phenomena, which was actually on the verge of bringing Iraq down. It was certainly operating and still is operating to bring Syria down. It still is doing the same with Iraq. Those are just two theaters of its operation. Afghanistan, I could quote, perhaps even Libya and Yemen as well. But primarily, it's Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, its support of Hezbollah and its support of Assad in Syria, its support of Iraq in terms of trying to make sure that it has sovereignty, or these nations or these regions have their own sovereignty, which has actually prevented the American plots and plans to use Daesh, to use ISIS as a means of breaking the region. But at the heart of it was ISIS was handed an ideology. It was handed a kind of very extreme, very violent version of Wahhabism, which originates, of course, in those same Arab states which are propped up by the Americans and who are supported by them, like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, you know, all of these central nations, which all supported this nasty virus known as Daesh. But of course, it's failed largely because of the military actions mm-hmm. of the Al-Quds force and many other reasons. But the Iranians have also countered with their own, of course, ability to be able to show people that there's another way. And the way is a successful model of Velayat-e Faqih, a successful model of Iran, which can actually sure. challenge the hegemony.
Well, taking a look at this sectarian card, Elijah Magnier, it seems like something that they went for was the fact that they wanted to use sectarian tensions to ultimately try to divide the two, Sunnis and Shias, and to form an ethnic mapping, of which we heard that echoed by the now U.S. president, but former VP of the U.S., Joe Biden, when he went for the partition of Iraq. Was that a concerted effort by the U.S. to ultimately partition Iraq, as stated in the past by then VP of the U.S., Biden?
Well, the Americans failed to confront Iran and its allies in the Middle East. Therefore, it was in need of another enemy that can fight Iran and can fight all the allies of Iran without the U.S. interfering in the middle of the battle, but supplying from behind and allowing groups to fight each other by triggering the reason behind that. So the problem in the 12ers is they stand against injustice. And the Sunnis in general, they obey to the rulers. By having a group of people who stand against injustice, they are extremely dangerous, because what the Americans are bringing to the Middle East is they are bringing dominance, and they're bringing death and destruction and control. This is what they've done in Afghanistan for 20 years. This is what they've done in Iraq. And then in Iraq, they have failed. So the only way is to turn the Shia and the Sunni against one another. And we've seen in Iraq how the Shia resisted for many years not to respond to the extremist Sunni, who are not really Sunni, but they have a particular ideology that was exploited by the Americans. I remember Colin Powell saying that they have boosted the image of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who lived in Kurdistan before 2003, under the control of the U.S. forces. So they were very much aware of the weight of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, what he represented, and they inflated him because they needed him to confront the Shia. And this is what they've done in Syria, by trying to blur the real narrative by saying that it is a sectarian war when 70% of the Syrian army are Sunni fighting Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And then we suddenly see, to prove the fake narrative of the Americans, that they claim it is Sunni Shia, when we've seen ISIS attacking Al-Qaeda, and they're both Sunni, both Wahhabis, and they both believe more or less in the same doctrine. So all this excuse by the Americans to bring the Islamophobia or the Shia phobia, or to bring the Sunni and the Shia together, has only one aim. It's a political aim, it's not a religious aim. But they found ground for that, and they supported, and they threw oil on fire, and they found who can listen to them, particularly when we see how the Americans supported Al-Qaeda in Syria, to understand that the objective of the Americans is not to defeat the extremists, but to support them as long as they serve their own objectives and purposes.
Well, it's very interesting the way that the whole approach of the U.S., Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, has been towards the terrorists that are Sunni. And I'm going to read off what I found to be something that was echoed on numerous sites. This one is from the Atlantic Council in a report where it said, U.S. made Iran the U.S.'s top priority in the Middle East, allowing for America's great big counter-Sunni extremist machine. Now notice, it doesn't call them, the U.S. doesn't call them terrorists. It calls them Sunni extremist machine, to shift focus to Shia groups. And it goes on to say, Iranian-backed Shia militant groups have begun to be sanctioned more regularly, even those that had fought against Daesh. Now, can you believe that? It says the Shia groups who are fighting against Daesh, they're still terrorists. Can you please explain the logic there?
Well, there is no logic there. As we've recognized, that America has a very one-sided and very single-minded objective. It is to crush the Islamic Republic of Iran's leadership and its kind of governance structures until it actually does what America says, until it hands over its wealth, it hands over its sovereignty, hands over all of its kind of autonomy. The Americans and the Israelis, for that matter, won't rest. And of course, you know, it's not just the card of the Shia Sunni that they've tried to play, because of course they know that Islamic Republic of Iran is predominantly Shia, although there's a very peaceful Sunni minority that lives in that region. There's a peaceful Jewish minority that lives there as well. But what they've tried to do is isolate Iran and try to create a propaganda that Iran is Shia, and it can never therefore be a leader of the Islamic world or the Western Asia, because it's fundamentally religiously different. Although the differences between the Shia and Sunni are absolutely minuscule in reality. Anybody who knows anything about religious depths knows that that's a fallacy to create that kind of level of division. But they've also used the Arab non-Arab card, don't forget. And with, again, Iranians and the whole notion of Persia and whatever, they've tried to also use that to accentuate the difference of Iranians from the Arabs. They've tried to create intra-Shia conflicts, as you talked about, intra-Sunni conflicts and the wars that have been going on between those groups and the parties. I mean, Libya was not a Shia-Sunni crisis. Again, it had a completely different dynamic. Syria was nothing to do with that. But this intra-Shia fighting, they've sponsored certain groups within Iran and outside Iran. Imam Khamenei has said very clearly that British Shiism, i.e. Western manufactured Shiism or religious ideology, is also a factor. And they use this largely as a psychological operation, you know, using the media. This is very, very, they're very clever at this. The US satellite media has hundreds and hundreds of propaganda platforms to advertise against Iran, to pump up the public against the Islamic Republic of Iran, to say that it's failing, that it isn't able to handle itself in a sort of a civilized way. This is all part of the propaganda that's also been going on. They've used every means necessary to try and really isolate Iran in that sense.
Well, that's the whole thing that Iran's leader was also talking about, in addition to what we've covered, Elijah Magdir, and that's the whole notion of Iranophobia. Of course, that's been going on for quite some time. But it's interesting the way that the U.S., if you can expand on this for us, if you agree, has created this Iranophobia as a tool to generate money. We know that the U.S. is always after vilifying a country, and, well, Iran's been on that list, maybe in the number one spot for quite some time. We're in the region, and Iranophobia through the U.S. has generated billions of dollars in military sales. Doesn't that hold true?
Yes, it is true, because creating Iranophobia with the support of the countries of the Middle East, particularly the Gulf countries, the U.S. has succeeded in implementing this Iranophobia in the leadership among the Arabs to push them to buy more weapons and to allow more military bases in the country. So this is how the Americans managed to implant military bases around Iran under the excuse of Iran creating a danger, potential danger, when Iran never attacked any Arab country since 1979. So if we look, I mean, we should not be surprised here in the West to look at Iran supporting the Palestinian Sunni in Gaza, supporting the Syrian and President Assad, where the majority are Sunni, supporting Hezbollah in Lebanon, supporting Iraq, and particularly when General Qasem Soleimani first supported the Kurds in Kurdistan, and then the Sunnis in Al-Anbar and the Shia in the south and in Baghdad, and then supporting the people in Venezuela. So we understand that Iran has gone beyond the religion, and that is extremely dangerous to the American objective and plans in the world. Today, the Americans are fighting the Russian and the Chinese for their hegemony. So Iran is standing in the way, giving an example for the last 43 years. And this is how the Americans managed to create this fear among the Arabs, to tell them that the Iranians have are expansionists, and they are expanding to other countries, and they will come and take your country. It is not possible, because this is only a fool person can believe that, because the Americans tried to occupy Afghanistan, and they have 1,800,000 soldiers, and they failed. They tried to occupy Iraq, and they have failed. They tried to occupy Syria. Again, they failed. They went to, with the multinational forces in the 80s in Lebanon, and they were kicked out. So no country can go and invade another country and be able to occupy the entire country and stay there forever. So this Iranian phobia has been also used by the Gulf country leaders to support the Americans and buy their weapons, so they can keep the danger of the American away from them.
Thank you, Saeed Mohsen Abbas from London, there, journalist and political commentator. Elijah Magnier, thank you so much. From Marseille, France, journalist and political analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, having trust. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of having trust when performing the call for good and forbidding evil. When we look at the Islamic teachings, it is said that it is necessary for the person who wants to perform the call for good and forbidding evil to have trust in the hearts of the people. Why? Because when a person who wants to reform others, if people do not trust him, they will never listen to him, and they will never trust on him because of lack of trust. If he does not have a trust in the hearts of the people, they will keep ignoring him, they will ignore him, and they will never come towards the path which he wants them, or the call which he is calling for. So they will never pay attention to such thing. Therefore, it is necessary to have the trust amongst the people. And this is the fourth condition of calling for good and forbidding evil, that when we want to bring people towards the right path, when we are struggling for the people, when we want people to make a good community, to have a pure community from corruption, from injustice, from cruelty, from oppression. Therefore, when we say something, it must have a value in the eyes of people. If my sayings do not have any kind of value in the hearts of the people, in the eyes of people, they will never listen to me. They will never pay attention to what I'm saying. Therefore, the fourth condition, which has been said, it is necessary to have trust amongst the people, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of having trust amongst the people when performing the obligation of calling for good and forbidding evil. The fourth condition is trust. And in the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala also has said that لَقَدْ جَاءَكُمْ رَسُولٌ مِّنْ أَنفُسِكُمْ. Certainly, a prophet from yourselves has come towards you, who is Aziz, Azizun Alayhi, who is loving for you, who you love, who is your friend. Ma'anittum harisun alaykum bil mu'minin, Ra'ufur Rahim. He is Ra'uf and Rahim. He is affectionate towards you. He is merciful towards you. And we know that people, they do trust the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. They used to call him Sadiq and Amin. Sadiq means the truthful. Amin was trustworthy. He was so trustworthy that they said that if Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam says to us that there is a caravan coming from behind that mountain, we believe in him even if there is no caravan. So this was the trust which was built amongst the people. At the time of the Prophet, this was the trust of the Prophet. That's why he was known as Amin. He was known as trustworthy. And he was known as Sadiq, a truthful person. And this is one of the characteristics of a person, that when we say that in the community, we want to perform the obligation of calling for good and forbidding evil, the person who is performing this, that must be trustworthy amongst the people. And this is one of the conditions that must match. And if someone does not have such a condition in him, then obviously when a person is not trustworthy, how can people listen to him? How can people go towards the goodness? Or how can he stop them from performing evil? Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
You're listening to Husseiniya from IRIB English Radio by Sayyid Abbas Razavian. Labbaik Ya Hussein.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Assalamu alayka ya Abba Abdullah. May our peace and salutations be upon you, Imam Hussein. I send my condolences to you, brothers and sisters, for the tragic event of Karbala. We were talking about benefiting truly from Ziyarat Ashura, this great gift from our fifth Imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Today we're going to talk about the last station, the spiritual journey that we were talking about, that first, the first part was bala, meaning that calamity that happened upon Imam Hussein. The second part is having huzn and grief for this bala. And the third is aligning ourselves, our mind, body, and soul with Imam Hussein. The fourth part is after we do this, we take these necessary steps during Muharram or during throughout the year. We ask Allah to make us reach al-maqam al-mahmud, the praiseworthy station. As we read in Ziyarat al-Ashura, وَأَسْأَلُهُ أَن يُبَلِّغَنِي الْمَقَامَ الْمَحْمُودَ لَكُمْ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ. I ask him to make me attain the praiseworthy status that you enjoin with Allah. What is al-maqam al-mahmud? The praiseworthy status in the Quran is for the Holy Prophet of Islam. And some of the narrations, it says that he has the capability of intercession. And that is what is meant, because he will intercede in the behalf of the sinners and will help them to attain heaven. Two, it is the position that the Holy Prophet had, and that is his true maqam, his true status will be noticed and apparent in the hereafter. As you know, the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, their real status, who they really are, will be shown in the hereafter. There are very few people that can understand who they are, but in the reality of the matter is, they'll be shown in the hereafter. So Imam Hussein, the Prophet of Islam, has this maqam. The Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, they have this maqam. And in this ziyarat, we ask Allah for us to reach this maqam. We are taught that pray for things that are very, very high, even though we might think of ourselves not fit for this position, but we're asked to pray, give us maqam al-mahmud. Now, what happens when a person reaches Maqam al-Mahmud? What happens when he does grieve for Imam Hussein? He takes his actions in alliance with Imam Hussein. What happens to such a person? He reaches complete heaven. His life becomes heaven. And he begins to enjoy life. He begins to enjoy his spirituality. And that is the entire purpose of all this worship that we're doing. That is the purpose of reciting Ziyarat Ashura, so we can get an elevated position. And what happens when somebody reaches that elevated position? They will be completely joyful, completely happy. They'll reach complete sa'adat. A lot of times when we talk about, in the modern world, when we talk about something, we're told to talk about what it does for us, to talk about the benefits of it, to talk about what it can do for you. When we talk about Islam, if we always talk about just the taklif and the obligations that we have, well, somebody might dry out or burn out. They'll say, this is too difficult for me. But if you talk to them and say, look, this is the effect. What will happen to you if you do this? If you take this path, which is incumbent upon us, but it still has benefits. And this is what we're going to talk about. That you reach al-maqam al-mahmud, which is the pinnacle, the highest spiritual position that someone can reach. Once they reach such a position, they begin to enjoy spirituality. We're going to be talking about that there are enjoyments in this world that are so great, that are so intense, they completely outweigh any other enjoyment in this world. That is when a person reaches this high position, that Allah gives them the tawfiq to get close to the Prophet of Islam, to get close to Imam Ali, Lady Fatima, Imam Hassan, and Imam Hussein. May our salutations be upon all of them. So this is great news for us, that as spiritual wayfarers, as people that are reading Ziyarat Ashura and crying for Imam Hussein, and enter the door of the mercy of Allah, they will be given a great reward. And that is, inshallah, the status of Al-Maqam Al-Mahmud, the praiseworthy station.
Standing here alone on a land so far from home, a place where angels cry while infant children die, Hussein has said goodbye. Praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. They can't bear to watch him leave. They cry out, Hussein, ya Hussein.
We were talking about the final pinnacle of spirituality, which is Al-Maqam Al-Mahmud, the praiseworthy station. And it is important for us to know that spirituality and ubudiyat and worshipping God has effects and consequences. The first thing for us to do, so when we want to be a better slave of God and be a better servant of Allah, and we want to reach Al-Maqam Al-Mahmud, is to be aware that there are better enjoyments than just the material. That the spiritual enjoyments, if we truly reach them, they're unparalleled to anything. Many of you have maybe gone to Hajj, have gone to Ziyarat and visited the Ahlul Bayt. Many of you have cried during the nights of Muharram and these nights, these days. You feel an intense pleasure. Actually, we can maybe say you become intoxicated with this pleasure. Because the love of the Ahlul Bayt, the love of God, is the most enjoyment that we can have. Some of the narrations, they talk about this. It says, for example, Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about this in this narration, إِنَّ أَطْيَبَ شَيْءٍ فِي الْجَنَّةِ وَلَذَّهُ حُبُّ اللَّهِ. What is the most enjoyable thing? What is the best thing in heaven? He said, is the love of God. in heaven with all the enjoyments, with everything that we could eat, anything that we could do. Imam Ali talks about the most lidha, atyab, the best thing that we can do in heaven, wa aladhahu, and the most enjoyful thing we can do, the most enjoyment that we can have, is love of God, walhubbu fillah, and loving in God's way. What is loving in God's way? Loving, for example, the Ahlul Bayt, loving the Prophet of Islam because his love of his messenger, loving Imam Ali, loving Sayyidah Fatima, loving Imam Hassan, loving Imam Hussein alayhi salam, because you're loving in the way of God. This is atyab and aladh, meaning these are the best and these are the most joyful things that we can do in heaven. My question to you is this: if this is the joy of the heaven, what is the difference between heaven and earth? Won't these things be a joy for us in this world? There are narrations that talk about, that make this and expand upon this enjoyment in heaven. And that is when we look at some of the hadith in Al-Kamil fi Ziyarat of Ibn Ghulawayh, it talks about in heaven there will be a group of people, they'll be asked to enter heaven. It's in the Day of Judgment. They're sitting around and talking to Imam Hussein. It says they're Huddathul Hussein alayhi salam. They're speaking with Imam Hussein. Then they tell them to heaven, but they don't want to. They're sitting next to Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein is their heaven. Then the ladies of paradise come and they ask them, why don't you enter heaven? They say they don't even look up to see how they look like. They don't want to be distracted with talking to Imam Hussein. This is the reality of the matter. This is when a person reaches al-maqam al-mahbud, the praiseworthy station, there's entire joy will be spirituality. You can love life and the material too, but in the way of God. But when he reaches and tastes spirituality, and he tastes a little bit how great it is to cry for Imam Hussein, how great it is to be in the majlis of Imam Hussein, how great it is to do the ziyarat of Imam Hussein, he'll say, God, I wish I could save all my money and just to visit Imam Hussein one more time. Prophet Ibrahim, in a story, it says that once one of the angels, I believe it's Jibreel, came and he heard the thana of God. He heard the praise of God. And he said, my Lord, what is this praise? This is such a great dhikr. This is such a great remembrance. I'll give half of my stock, half of my flock of sheep, if I can hear this one more time, the praise of my Lord, if I can hear it. So he hears it and then he hears it one more time and says, oh Allah, I'll give the rest of my sheep, the rest of my flock, if I can hear this for another time. So when we compare spiritual benefits, spiritual joy, and you truly practice Islam in a way that you truly enjoy it, you reap the benefits of Islam, you will be blessed with a joy that outweighs all joys. And I believe that the followers and lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, they feel this the most. They feel halawatul iman, the sweetness of faith. So when a person reaches maqam al-mahmud, they reach the sweetness of faith, and inshallah, they'll be raised with the Prophet of Islam, with Imam Ali, Sayyidah Fatima, with Imam Hassan, with Imam Hussein, alayhi wasalam ajma'in, in the heaven, and inshallah, we will also be with them in this world too, inshallah. وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وأهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافت غازا
جروم هيوز بروسلز
سعيد بورزا لندن
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The Seoul Defense Dialogue Security Forum addressed the North Korea issue Wednesday as leading military strategists grappled for a coherent policy toward Pyongyang. In South Korea, President Yoon Suk-yeol's hard line involves strengthening the U.S. alliance and bolstering military capabilities, including a potential preemptive strike.
Kill chain will pre-detect North Korea's nuclear missile launch and be able to interfere with it, blocking any incoming nuclear attacks. And in order to prevent the worst case, we are intensively organizing the defense budget and developing military strategies to prepare a military retaliation.
President Yoon promised to normalize operations of the U.S. anti-ballistic missile system, THAAD, which was deployed in 2017, with new equipment brought in late Sunday night in an attempt to foil local protesters. Yoon has said he would like to deploy more THAAD missile batteries. At the forum, President Yoon's hard line was echoed by Japan.
There could be a lot of sanctions that would be imposed together with other countries, and there could be certain measures which some countries can do unilaterally, and it's a kind of a combination, but we have to share the same goal of urging North Korea to accept the terms. We have to figure out where it hurts most for the North Koreans.
Several forum speakers stressed coordinated sanctions, which have so far failed, yet offered few alternatives. Settling the issue of North Korea's nuclear and missile programs and ending sanctions against Pyongyang will require bringing North Korea to the negotiating table. But so far, the U.S. and its allies, South Korea and Japan, appear unwilling to provide much incentive for North Korea to re-enter talks. Also on Wednesday, the nuclear envoys of the U.S., South Korea, and Japan met in Tokyo to coordinate strategies seeking to denuclearize North Korea. The U.S. repeated its offer to meet unconditionally with North Korea, while U.S.-led unilateral and U.N. Security Council sanctions remain in place. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The Italian government has introduced a number of measures aimed at curbing electricity consumption this winter amid soaring gas prices and fears of more disruptions. Italy relies on natural gas for 40% of its electricity production. On Tuesday, Roberto Cingolani, the Minister for the Ecological Transition, announced energy-saving measures ranging from turning down thermostats in apartment blocks and public buildings by 1 degree and shortening the time the heating can be on by 1 hour a day and 15 days across the year.
It could be a solution, but on second thought, I don't know how useful this measure would be. What I do know is that it's always us people who pay the price.
Hospitals, nursing homes, primary and play schools will be exempt from the energy-saving measures. The policy introduced by the Italian government is part of an EU plan which calls on member states to voluntarily reduce their gas demand by 15% compared to their average consumption in the past 5 years between August 1st and March 31st next year. However, the gas demand reduction becomes mandatory if supplies reach crisis levels.
Italy has decided to do without the Russian gas, which amounted to about 40% of its supplies, and opted to embrace a supplier diversification strategy. Also, Germany did the same. Now it takes five members of the bloc to demand the European Council to make the energy saving plan mandatory. For instance, if Russia opts to cut altogether its gas supplies to Europe.
There are concerns on how the implementation of energy-saving measures will be monitored by the government. For now, the Ministry for the Ecological Transition has called on individuals to play their part. It remains to be seen whether this will be enough. Max Civili, Rome.
Growing up in poverty is among the many things distinguishing presidential candidate Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva from his opponents. The difficulties he and his family faced from a young age undoubtedly influenced his policymaking during his government. The former president's cousin took us to visit the small clay house Lula lived in until he was seven. located in the rural area outside of Garanhuns in the northeastern state of Pernambuco.
Esse casebrezinho aqui construído de forma muito singelo.
So the shack next door here, which built in a very simple way, was once the home of our president Lula, along with his mother, his father, and his seven brothers and sisters before he emigrated to São Paulo, naturally to save of hunger.
Conditions in this part of the countryside were difficult. There was no running water, and it was only around 2006, under Lula's presidency, that rainwater collection systems were built in this and many other communities.
In 1952, I would have to go out to get water. I had to go 18 kilometers on a donkey to get 4 jugs of water every morning. I'd leave at 2 or 3 in the morning and would be gone until 6 or 7 a.m. with the 4 containers of water, with the donkeys all dying of thirst.
Despite the Workers' Party's advances on economic rights, poverty alleviation, eradicating hunger, and in bridging inequality generally, conditions are now deteriorating under the neoliberal government of Jair Bolsonaro.
Today we live in a similar fashion, but things improved after Lula became president. Every house around here that didn't have a rainwater cistern has 2 of them now, and that has helped the people a lot to be able to work. It helped against poverty. Through the banks, it gave credit to poor people, and that is how Brazil got better. And now with Bolsonaro, things are getting as bad as back in 1952, when Lula left this area.
It's candidate Lula da Silva, who many working-class Brazilians are saying they identify with most. Camila Escalante, Pernambuco.
Finally, after weeks of divisive debates and bitter infighting, Britain's ruling Conservative Party has elected a new leader, Liz Truss, who also goes on to become the next Prime Minister, ending a power vacuum at number 10, which led to public fear and economic uncertainty. Truss was officially appointed after meeting Queen Elizabeth II at Balmoral Tuesday morning. Her predecessor, Boris Johnson, had earlier issued his final speech outside number 10 ahead of resigning his post.
This is it, folks. Thank you, everybody, for coming out so early this morning. In only a couple of hours, I will be in Balmoral to see Her Majesty the Queen. And the torch will finally be passed to a new Conservative leader.
Truss has secured the faith of the Tory membership. However, polling suggests the Conservatives have lost favour with the wider electorate. But Truss supporters believe she has what it takes to turn things around.
Liz Truss wasn't responsible for the mess that the country is now in. Indeed, Rishi Sunak, her rival as Chancellor of the Exchequer, he was behind many of the policies which involved an increase in the national insurance, basically a tax on jobs, and of course inflationary policies that have exacerbated the crisis that Britain is currently in. So Liz Truss will be a new broom that will come in and perhaps sweep up the mess that Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson, her predecessor as Prime Minister, created.
Allegations have been spread of a possible plan by Boris on returning to power, agitating from the backbenches to undermine Truss's leadership, as he did under David Cameron and Theresa May.
Boris Johnson, to be honest, I met him and he is like unpredictable. He can do anything. I think at the moment he will be away for a while, but he must have a plan. Always he have a plan. Boris, he like stay for a little while, then he have something else. So he's not going to stop for sure.
Truss's first big challenge will be dealing with the cost of living crisis. She's pledged a clear plan within a week, with expectations of a cap freeze on energy bills. But winter looms and bills remain eye-wateringly high.
Even before Truss took office, speculation has swirled regarding whether she has what it takes or not to save the economy, fight off backbench criticism, and also to hold on to power for the Conservatives in a general election, the next being scheduled for January 2025, meaning that Truss will have to make a meaningful impact and quickly in order to hold on to her position at number 10 for the long term. Robert Carter, London.
The Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in August 2021 brought about rapid and momentous changes to the country's economy. which was already reeling under the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, persistent insecurity, and weakened private sector confidence. Following the power shift, the war-torn country's economic activities were greatly affected, with the private sector being hit hard. Many private firms have experienced a drastic decline in consumer demand for their products and services. A survey by the World Bank shows that many firms in Afghanistan are adjusting to the new business environment, but most are still facing daunting challenges. The majority of private firms have responded to those challenges by laying off employees, shifting to cash and informal payment channels, shrinking investments, and lowering staff salaries.
Today, factories are facing a lot of problems, especially with raw materials, oil, and power. In our factory, we did our best to continue work. However, we were forced to reduce the number of our employees from 120 to 60. We also made some changes to salaries. We're trying to survive at any cost in this harsh situation so that we can help some people put food on their tables and make ends meet.
The survey has also found that employment remained around 50% lower than before August 2021. Most firms are operating below their full capacity and are only considered partially open. This, as U.S. sanctions have disrupted international payments and limited access to bank accounts and formal banking.
The biggest challenges the Afghan private sector is facing are the new government's unrecognized status and banking problems. You know that Afghanistan is importing raw materials from abroad, but today our business people are unable to transfer their money. The cruel sanctions are not posing any pressure on the ruling Taliban, but on the private firms and the welfare of our people. Our country needs to be considered as a member of the global village once again and start interacting with the world.
In the meantime, the new survey confirmed the resilience of Afghanistan's private sector, which can play a key role in the economic recovery of the country and improving the livelihood of the Afghan people. Private sector firms in Afghanistan are impacted by the loss of international assistance and banking relationships. Business people here are calling for positive cooperation between the Taliban and global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
For the first time since the beginning of the UN brokered agreement in April, Yemenis are waiting in long lines in front of a limited number of operating petrol stations in the capital Sana'a to refill their vehicles. Yemen is suffering from a fresh fuel shortage due to Saudi Arabia's ongoing blockade.
The Saudi-led coalition wasn't sincere in implementing the terms of the armistice, and it did not open flights to other destinations from Sana'a Airport, and the salary issue still persists. The enemy is still using various methods to pressure the Yemenis, such as seizing fuel ships. But our leadership is studying the positions that can be taken regarding the Saudi violations of the UN armistice. There will be an appropriate decision at the right time, as the leadership is keen to move towards a solution to end the war.
The Yemeni Petroleum Company announced the implementation of the emergency plan and is distributing fuel to a few stations only. It held the United Nations responsible for the consequences of the Saudi violation, as it did not ensure the implementation of the armistice terms that included allowing fuel ships to enter Yemen without any restrictions.
The fuel crisis that the liberated areas are experiencing contradicts the United Nations statements that there is a smooth flow of entry of fuel ships into the Port of Hodeida. If there had been a smooth entry, we would not have experienced this crisis. The UN is a clear partner in decision posed on the Yemeni people, because it did not force a Saudi-led coalition to implement what was agreed upon. We hold the United Nations responsible for the continued violations of the Saudi-led coalition.
Since the beginning of the truce, only 33 fuel ships out of 54 have entered the country. However, Riyadh is still holding 9 fuel ships despite them obtaining UN permits, and this is a clear violation of the UN brokered agreement.
Observers believe that the Saudi seizure of oil ships and the Yemeni army's recent military parades indicate a return to military escalation. They say the UN brokered truce has failed to achieve tangible results in relieving the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Liz Truss has begun celebrations after winning the race to become the new leader of the ruling Conservative Party, making her the next British Prime Minister. beating her rival finalist Rishi Sunak and taking over the post from her predecessor Boris Johnson. The Foreign Secretary, who won 81,326 votes of Tory members to the former Chancellor's 60,000, takes over from Boris Johnson, who was ousted by his own MPs earlier this summer.
I'd like to pay tribute to my fellow candidates, particularly Rishi Sunak. It's been a hard-fought campaign. I think we have shown the depth and breadth of talent in our Conservative Party. Friends and colleagues, thank you for putting your faith in me to lead our great Conservative Party, the greatest political party on earth.
The feeling of joy over her victory will not last long.